New music discovery is right here on WDET. I'm Ryan Patrick Hooper, the host of In the Groove, our new show dedicated to new releases, new music, and the stories behind them. Get in the groove with me weekdays at noon on WDET.
Hi, I'm Andalisi, and this is Essential Conversations. Well, in this episode, I talk with Grammy-winning songwriter, producer, and multimedia artist Allie Willis. She is larger than life and has written everything from hit songs for Earth, Wind, and Fire to songs for the Broadway musical The Color Purple, and she's got stories about everyone from Bob Dylan to James Brown. So, Miss Willis, yeah. You have been quite busy. You have logged a lot of life in your life, so it appears.
27 other people's lives plus 14 of my own.
Absolutely. You've done it very gracefully. But before we talk about The D, this micro documentary and this amazing song that you wrote, I do want people to know a little bit more about you and your history as a songwriter in particular.
Cool.
I absolutely love Earth, Wind, and Fire. Love them. And one of my favorite songs is Boogie Wonderland.
Mm-hmm.
And you, my friend, are responsible for that song.
Yep. I was actually, this would have been 1978, totally starving songwriter, as close to being on welfare as you could get without officially being on it. But, you know, food stamps, medical assistance, whole thing. And people were doing my songs, but, you know, nothing really significant. And if it was a big artist, it wasn't the single. And you can't make any money unless it's the single. But first one ever was Bonnie Raitt. And that was a complete fluke. It happened on the day that I was dropped from my record label. I had one album out. And I was very uncomfortable performing. I had never been on stage before other than in a second grade play at Schultz Elementary School here at where I was a tree. With no lines. So, and then the record company, when my album came out, put me in front of 10,000 people. I'd never been on stage before, opening for a folk singer, and I had an all-black band dressed as sequined vegetables. It was a mismatch from the beginning. So in the middle of the fourth gig, I literally jumped off the stage in the middle of an instrumental of one of my songs and just walked out the door, and that was it. With the band screaming at me, like, you can't do that, that's so unprofessional. And I'm like, I am out of here. So I was dropped by my label, which was Columbia Epic, which was Sony. That day, a friend of mine who was a background singer said, you know, you shouldn't be alone and, you know, come to this recording session with me. Which is not where you want to be if you've been dropped. You do not want to be at someone else's recording session. But she was insistent, and I went, and this was 1974, and it was one of those flukes where I walked in, and the chick singer, who I had no idea who she was, turned around and took one look at me and literally fell to her knees and started bowing and just said, what are you doing here? Go home and write me a song. And it was Bonnie Raitt. You know, I had to, like, call up friends when I'm running home to write for this chick. Like, who's Bonnie Raitt? Who's Bonnie Raitt?
What song did you write for her?
It was on her Streetlights album, and it was a song called Got You On My Mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then she took me on the road with her. So that, and then that, as a background singer, I thought, ooh, this is nicer than being, you know, you don't have any pressure back here. You just have a good time. So really, that night, I, you know, decided, oh, I'm just going to be a songwriter. That's the part of it that I enjoyed the most. I mean, that all actually has flipped now. Now I'm obsessed with performing, but it took almost 40 years. So Bonnie was first. Then, you know, you figure stuff's getting cut, it'll start to roll. But, it did very slowly, though. And then 4 years later, Patti LaBelle heard some of my stuff. And she actually paid for me to come into the studio to put the songs down because I had no money to, you know, make demos. She wanted me to write with a friend of hers. I thought, well, I'm finally with the big fish. I don't want, like, to be stuck with the friend who I assumed was, like, an unknown, like myself. And I avoided going into this studio that she kept telling me to go into. I was there for about 3 days. And then I was walking down the hall and the door to that studio opened. This guy walks out and I duck into the bathroom because it's like, no, I want to stay with Patty. You know, I don't want to be with this guy. And he followed me into the bathroom and literally instructed me, like, come into Studio B. And so I was trapped and I went in, had no idea who he was, but there was an enormous amount of keyboards. I had never seen that many keyboards in my life. So I thought he's got to be something, you know. And we literally started writing right away. And we wrote a song in an hour. We were in the middle of the second song. He got a phone call. And that's the first time I could really look at him. And then I looked around the room and I thought, oh my God, all these keyboards. And I realized it's Herbie Hancock. So I ended up writing in those 3 days, like a third of his album that was coming out. So between Patty, Herbie, and a friend of mine started sleeping with someone in Earth, Wind, and Fire. I know, it's better than what you thought you were going to get. And
not the typical songwriting story, no.
None of these are. And she said to me, you should really be writing with Earth, Wind, and Fire. So she actually put me with Verdine White, who was original member bass, still to this day, bass player, a fantastic guy. We started writing, and he said, I'm going to tell my brother Maurice White about you. So I never thought that would happen, you know, given that I literally was like going in the little commissary that they had in the studio there and stealing like sugar packets and mustard, and that would be like dinner. But the phone rang one day, and it was literally Maurice White, and all he said to me was, he asked me if I would write the entire next Earth, Wind, and Fire album with him. Didn't even say, do you want to write a song? You know, nothing. It was just like, I want you to write the next Earth, Wind, and Fire album with me. So I went in the next day, and we started September, the very first day. When I walked in, actually, they were working on the intro, and I just thought, this is the happiest sounding thing I've ever heard. Please let that, you know, this be what they want from me. So the only things that he told me about the song, and I was writing it with him, and he had started it with Al McKay, who was the guitar player in the group. The only things he told me was that it was to be the third song in a trilogy that he and Al had already written and had already been out, the first two. And the first one was Sing a Song, Earth, Wind, and Fire. Second was Best of My Love, The Emotions. To me, two of the happiest songs ever. So this third one had to be like the grand finale. Also that he wanted it called September.
Why did he want it to have that title?
I don't know if I asked him about that so much as I remember a huge debate about the date, because it was going to be in the first line. Do we remember the night of September? And we tried everything from the first through the, you know, I don't know how long is September, 30? You know, we tried everything. And I remember the 21st, that one feeling the best in the pocket. I was speaking to Maurice's wife, and she said, you know, the 21st of September was supposed to be the birthday of our son. And he actually came a little late. But I only found that out a month ago. So, like, it took me 40 years to find out the significance. And so those were the only thing. Has to be called September. Has to be the third in the sequence of these other two songs. I had been a journalism major in college and felt very strongly. I hated typical song lyrics. I really wanted there to be, like, an intelligence so that if the music was pulled out, it would hold up as a story or a poetry or something, not just, you know, ooh, baby. And so I was having a lot of trouble with the simplicity of, do you remember the 21st night of September? Love was changing the minds of pretenders while chasing the clouds away. You know, I'm getting a break with Earth, Wind, and Fire. So how hard am I going to push, you know? So I figure, okay, we'll like spice it up at the chorus. Most songwriters have certain kind of phrases, nonsensical phrases, that they use when you're first constructing a melody. You know, you don't like spew out the lyric.
It's like a placeholder.
Yeah, it's like, you know, your version of what La 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 right. is. And Maurice always used Ba-dee-ya. Like if it was That's the Way of the World, it would have been Ba-dee-ya, Ba-dee-ya. So September, the chorus started out, and we knew we wanted September in the first line. So that started out as, you know, Ba-dee-ya. Say, do you remember Ba-dee-ya dancing in September? So I constantly said, we are not leaving Ba-dee-ya, are we? You know, it has to be replaced with real words. As we were writing September, but then we needed to start on the next album. And that's the album that Boogie Wonderland was on after The Love Is Gone. So though the bulk of September got written at first, other songs started creeping in. So it took probably over a period of about 2 months to finish it. Every time we would get to the chorus, I would say, please, can we, let's put some words in there. This song is a hit. What does Ba-dee-ya mean? So finally, it was the very last night of recording, had to be out of the studio at midnight. It was like 11:50, literally. I was on my knees clutching his thigh. Maurice White had the best thighs in the history of music. And I am begging him, you know, Ba-dee-ya, we can't say Ba-dee-ya. And in his biography that came out last year, he actually said I was crying. So it was worse than I'm just on my knees clutching his thigh. I'm crying on my knees clutching his thigh. And he just wasn't changing it. So he is this incredibly spiritual, calm man. And I just finally said to him, what the f*** does Ba-dee-ya mean? And he said to me, who the f*** cares? And that was it. And it stayed. And thank God, because it's like no words could have ever been better, fit more in the pocket. So I learned the biggest songwriting lesson of my life that night, which was never let the lyric get in the way of the groove. That if the beat is there, the melody is there, the feel is there, people are going to know what you're, you know, implying with all of this. And it's true, because that song, you know, I always say, if that song were played at a funeral, the corpse's toe would be tapping. You know, he was right. So, Ba-dee-ya. So we did that at the same time as writing all the songs that were going on the upcoming album, which was called I Am. Mm-hmm. And September was written specifically to go on Greatest Hits Volume Number 1. They wanted one new single for that. So, and then Boogie Wonderland was an outside song that I had written with a guy named John Lynn, who had also written some Earth, Wind, and Fire stuff. And he went on to write songs like Crazy for You, Madonna, Save the Best for Last, a whole bunch of stuff. But anyway, we wrote Boogie Wonderland as an outside song and took it to them. They cut the track, but it was actually supposed to be for a cousin of someone in the group who was, you know, had a new group. And we were like beside ourselves because here you've got Earth, Wind, and Fire on this track and then these vocals that are not even close to Earth, Wind, and Fire. So we just campaigned for months. And literally at the final hour that the album was due, Maurice said, you know, screw it, threw his vocal on, and that was it. So very lucky with that one.
How do you feel when you hear that on the radio? Do you always listen or do you turn it off? I was listening to an interview with Don Henley that said every time an Eagles song comes on, he turns it off.
Has to turn it off.
What about when you hear September or Boogie Wonderland?
It's different with the songwriter because songwriters, you are just at the mercy of so many people as opposed to, you know, it's your group, it's your song.
Let's talk about some of your collaborations. You have collaborated with a lot of people, yeah. Everyone from Bob Dylan to the folks that you mentioned to George Clinton. I mean, the list goes on and on.
And I've never met George Clinton.
Right. You guys did this sort of
Howard the Duck.
Howard the Duck.
It was an incredible combination. It was me, George Clinton, and Thomas Dolby.
Yeah.
But Thomas I used to work with a lot. And he had started that with George. And so I was just so excited to write with George Clinton. But to this day, despite us both being Detroiters, I've never met him.
You're going to have to change that.
Yeah, I hope.
You're going to have to change that for sure. What collaboration were you intimidated by?
Bob Dylan. But I actually, the two that I was probably intimidated the most are two of my, ended up being my favorites because they were so interesting. One was Dylan. I drove to his house in Malibu.
So he called you?
Yeah. It was the same girlfriend.
She's so instrumental.
Had the best sex life ever.
She's so instrumental.
And that's
how
that happened. And no, and I can't obviously say her name because I've divulged something about her, but she was very much responsible for some of the best things that ever happened to me. But she did all the work, you know.
So she knows Bob Dylan and says,
yes.
You should meet friend.
I tended, this was in the 80s, and I tended to be put with a lot of major superstars who had kind of lost their way. Were not as hot anymore as they were. Because my thing was, I was always more interested in the person. I was less interested in the music. I was a big, and still am, a big party thrower. And I'm interested in people as party guests, always. So, and, you know, Bob Dylan's going to make it a pretty exciting party. So I didn't hustle him the way that I think a lot of other music people were hustling him. And when I drove up to his place, it had this very long driveway, and there were piles of scrap metal, like old fenders and, you know, just pieces of metal. And my dad was a scrap dealer here in Detroit. So as I'm driving up the driveway and I see these scrap piles, I go, well, there's my opening to him. It's, you know, are you into, like, scrap metal? Do you weld? And so we shared a piece of welding equipment that we bought together, a plasma cutter, it was called. And my house, I live in, it was built as the party house for MGM in 1937. And it's a classic streamlined modern deco house. And he's totally into architecture. So once we would start working back at my place, he literally would spend hours just crawling along the floors, like looking at the floorboards and how the molding, you know, met. So that part of it was unbelievable. I should have pushed a little bit harder on the music because it ended up being more about the style stuff and the artistic shared interest than it did about the music. But it was unbelievable getting to know him in that way. I had a lot, even though I don't play, I like to have all the instruments at my place because just the structure of the house, it's a fun place to work. So I had like all kinds of synthesizers and he wasn't really familiar with them yet. He was still very, you know, electric guitar. And I had a big keyboard. It was called the Prophet 10. And Prophet 5s were the one that most people had. But I had this double, you know, rack. I actually still have a cassette of this. He just, like, put his hands down and, you know, it was turned on. And he, like, made this chord. And he jumped back and he said, that's how Prince does it? And Raspberry Beret had just come out. And the main synth sound on Raspberry Beret is a preset on the Prophet. So he had no idea how these sounds were made. Well, it's just by the keyboard. There's the sound. So I have about 2 hours of him playing Prince songs, which is incredible. So I'm the only one that has that. So he was great. And then James Brown, that was the other one who, you know, was the godfather of soul. And I literally got a call from BMI, you know, ASCAP BMI. And I was signed to BMI, he was signed to BMI, and they just said, you want to meet James Brown? I said, yeah, and they said, well, he'll be over in 45 minutes. And he came over, my front door slides open. It's not a normal front door. And the doorbell rang, and I slide this heavy wooden door open, and his eyes go from, they're kind of at my eye level, but as the door is sliding, his eyes are following the door, And then he just starts at my feet, and literally the eyes go all the way up to my head. And, you know, I dress a little unusually, and my hair has always been like this. And he just went from this no expression on his face to, as his eyes are climbing up my body, by the time he got to my face, he was smiling so broadly, and he said, "Oh, we're going to get along." That was the first thing he said to me. And he walked in with a big fur coat and an entourage. And a friend of mine had been over that day. We were going through videos because I've videoed almost every day of my life since my first video camera in 1978. And so we were labeling stuff. And I had said to him, you can't pick up that camera and shoot him, you know, when he's here. And even though I was dying to, but thought, no, can't do that. And as soon as James Brown walked into my house, he saw the video camera looking there, and he looked at my friend and he said, "Pick it up, fool." So I have the entire first day, which was about 6 hours, and we got along unbelievably great, but for a lot of the same reason. Like he said, they were putting him with a lot of younger songwriters because he hadn't had a hit, you know, in a while. This was right before Living in America came out. And that was the result of his, that wasn't me, but that was Rick Derringer, I think, of him meeting, you know, younger contemporary songwriters who were, active at the time. He just went insane for my collection. That's why the biggest part of my collection is black memorabilia, artifacts, clothing, mainly from late 60s, early 70s. There was a whole bunch of board games that were from Detroit. There was a company here called Theme Productions, and they were like kind of board games of, it wasn't the Jacksons, but it was based on the Jacksons, like, you know, how to be in a band. And there's an incredible one called Slang-a-Lang. That's black bingo. So instead of B-I-N-G-O, it's B-L-A-C-K. And the middle square, instead of free, it's we are free people. And then all the, instead of numbers, it's like Chitlins, Funky Broadway. I mean, it's unbelievable. So he saw all that stuff that I had, and he said there was no money back in the day to distribute any of these black products. So if something was made in Detroit, it wasn't going to get any farther than Cleveland. So he really made me promise to keep collecting that stuff specifically. And he said, you know, because it is like a museum here. So on the words of the Godfather, you know, I just kept going. And I am in 2020 having a huge exhibit of it at the Charles Wright.
Oh, that's going to be awesome.
That'll weave in, you know, my songs, the collection, you know, all of it. So
how many
thank you, James Brown.
How many songs did you end up writing with him?
Nothing that came out. I was, you know, maybe the starts of maybe four or five. Mm-hmm. But my thing with him was more we would just, like, gab. And he loved my little studio. You know, it was just a studio in the house. But when Living in America came out, MTV did a special on him, and they said, okay, what studio do you want to film at? And they're expecting, you know, Record Plant, Sunset mm-hmm. Sound. And he said, no, it's got to be at Allie's. So it's this whole special in my little bedroom. It's
my gosh,
great.
That's great. What's the biggest misconception about him after spending so much time with him? Something we don't know about him or how he is or how he thinks.
I never saw the crazy side, and I know that the crazy side was there. So I never saw anything, and the wife that he had all the problems with, I always got along great with. I would just say that he could spot and appreciate the artist in you. I always felt that when he was with me, it was a real relief that I wasn't like a Hollywood person, you know. And he did very specifically tell me he didn't enjoy a lot of these collaborations they were putting him in because they would sit down and play him like bad James Brown. You know, he doesn't need someone to write him a James Brown record. He needs someone who inspires him with something different that he will feel more like James Brown, and, you know, but 10 years later or whatever. I felt with me, he could really see into the soul of who I was as an artist, and very encouraging because I was painting a lot at that time too. And a lot of my pieces were three-dimensional and sculptural, like, you know, and I would do them. I did one for Boogie Wonderland. I did one for Neutron Dance. These huge, like 8 foot by 10 feet, weighed almost a ton, but motorized, you know, and people dancing and lights flashing. And he loved that. And he, I think he understood, even though we never did it, he understood the value of being a true multimedia artist. And at that time, especially in the 80s, you were not looked upon well if you were trying to combine art and video and music. It's like you were either a songwriter or you were a set designer or you were, and he was someone who loved the idea of all of that being crushed together in one expression.
Coming up next, Ali Willis talks about the night Otis Redding died, writing for The Color Purple, and stories about James Brown and Prince. Hi, I'm Ann DeLisi, and here is the conclusion of my conversation with Ali Willis.
When I see Prince perform, I can't help but see James Brown.
Yeah, well, no question.
And I wonder what James Brown thought about Prince.
Yeah, never talked about it. I could see from both sides of things I've heard of him, I could see him being happy about it, and I could see him being pissed about it, you know. But yeah, we never talked about that.
Clearly Prince was.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet Prince?
Well, when I was writing the Earth, Wind & Fire album, at that point they had their own record company. And there was this kid that was always up there. And he was, he had this fishnet top, this red fishnet top he would wear all the time, and teeny little short shorts. Never talked, had no idea why he was there, but he was always there. So when the I Am album, the Earth, Wind & Fire album, was finally done, they called me up and said, you know, come into Maurice's office and you're going to hear the album sequenced. And hearing an album sequenced is very different than hearing, you know, just 10 songs. So I was all excited. I knew it was going to be totally emotional for me that, you know, my life was going to change with this. Maurice, they were out on tour, Earth, Wind & Fire. So I go into the office and I'm shutting the door. And my girlfriend said, and she called him the kid. She said, can the kid listen with you? And I thought, oh, God, this kid, he has no personality. He never smiles. But he is obviously an Earth, Wind & Fire fanatic because he is there. Literally, I'd never been there when he wasn't there. And so I sat listening to this entire album with me kind of in the back of the room, the kid very close to the speaker, so he was in my eyesight the whole time. I felt it kind of ruined it for me because I wanted to be emotional, but then there was this person sitting in there. And then 4 months later, I Want to Be Your Lover came out, and I went, oh my God. I was sitting there with Prince listening to the album that I know he worshipped. And that was it. So it went from being, I wasn't happy about it, to, oh my God, this is the best thing that ever happened to me. And that was it. And then I never saw him again after that. But I saw him easily 20 times hanging up, you know, around them. And then it ended up that was, they both had the same manager, and the manager was running the record company.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, it was unbelievable.
That is pretty unbelievable.
So really good friends, though, with a lot of people in the band and, you know, Wendy and Lisa. Mm-hmm. So always had some contact.
Mm-hmm. Who is the one that got away that you wanted to work with that it just didn't, or a slight miss?
This was a big miss. Well, there are two. One, I got up and walked out of her showcase because it was putting me to sleep. I just felt like she was a glorified cocktail singer, at least with the material she was doing, and I did not hear through it. And that was Whitney Houston, where Clive Davis invited like 10 top songwriters before her first album to, you know, come see a showcase. And, you know, she was on her third song, and I just said, I'm out of here. And I left. So that is a big one.
Yeah.
And then the other one who I was always told wanted to meet me, and who used to, there was a studio in Hollywood called Sunset Sound. And back in the day, you know, you would book a studio for 6 months, you know, if you were cutting an album. Earth, Wind & Fire always was in Studio A. Michael Jackson, always in Studio B. We were never there at the same time, but Verdine used to say to me, Michael wants to meet you, Michael wants to meet you. This was 1981. Finally, I was there in an afternoon, and Verdine said, Michael is here, let's go next door. So he takes me to meet Michael, and my hand is in his hand. We're shaking hands, and someone runs in and says, Richard Pryor just set himself on fire. And Michael Jackson's hand literally went limp in my hand, and he fainted. He went, like, back. That was the last time I saw Michael Jackson. That was the first and last time. My career
is filled. That
is
a crazy story.
I saw Otis Redding's plane crash. I mean, I've had crazy things in my life.
You saw his plane crash?
Yeah, well, it was Madison, Wisconsin, 1968. No plane should have been flying. You could not see 1 inch in front of your head. And I lived in a sorority house, yes, on a lake. And the snow was like packed against the window. And there was this huge boom. And it was almost like I can't even explain it. The snow just like shifted on the window. And I ran out into the hallway and I said, what was that? Who, you know, did anyone see what it was? And no one even heard it. I was the only one that heard this, evidently. I was going to an Otis Redding concert that night, which is why he was flying into Madison. It was 10 below zero. It was absolutely freezing. And they kept us waiting outside this club. It was called The Factory. Every club was called The Factory in that day. About 2 hours after we were supposed to be let in, the window on the second floor of this building opened, and a guy leaned over with a megaphone, and I turned around and I said to my date, that was a plane crash. And then at that moment, he said, you know, there was a plane crash, you know, today, and it's believed Otis Redding and the Barquets were on it. And then they immediately released Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, and I sat on the dock of the lake for 3 days just watching the whole everything being removed. I saw him. I saw Carla Thomas walking out on the ice to identify him. I mean, it was crazy. And then 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, there were these two kids on Facebook that at least every couple of months would write me, we want to write with you. We want to write with you. We live in Miami. You know, please come to Miami. One was 18 and one was 22. They stayed on me for at least 2 years, I would say. And finally, you know, just knew them by their, like, you know, whatever their screen names were. They said, we're coming to L.A. And I thought, these kids have been, like, so faithful with this. I'm going to let them come over and, you know, let's see if something happens. Got along with these two unbelievably well. Wrote these great songs. Second day, we're sitting in my living room, and a couple times they had mentioned their uncle. And I finally said, well, who's your uncle? And the older one looked at me strangely, and he said, well, you know my last name. I said, I have no idea what your last name is. And he threw his checkbook over, and it was Chris Redding. And I said, you are not going to believe this, but I saw your uncle. You know, so I believe, like, that was fate all the way. Like, what drew them to me? And why did I say yes? So, but again, I got 1,000 stories like that.
You do have 1,000 stories. Have you ever worked with Quincy Jones?
I have never worked directly with Quincy Jones, but, well, yes, hello. I wrote the musical The Color Purple, and mm-hmm. he was a producer, so I guess. but, you know, have been with him a zillion times. Adored everything he was doing, always got along with him great, but I never wrote directly with him or for him.
What is his greatest gift, do you think?
Okay, this would only be because I'm friends with so many people that worked with him, primarily Saida Garrett, who, you know, all the Michael Jackson stuff. She, you know, wrote Man in the Mirror. She did that duet with Michael. I Just Can't Stop Loving You. And has worked with Quincy for 100 years. Also Brenda Russell, my Color Purple collaborator. And then tons of musicians. I think everyone just loved that he was incredibly sophisticated musically, had very distinct ideas about how he heard things. And then he had this history because he was, you know, much older than us, but with such a classy history over so many genres of music. It was definitely someone who I would have loved to have worked with. And I know he respected my work. I mean, my father once came out to California and I took him to a party. I can't even remember at whose house. And as we were walking up this driveway, Quincy Jones was walking down. And I introduced him to my father and he said, "Your daughter's a genius." And I thought, "I love you, Quincy Jones." But, you know, never got the chance to really work with him.
You brought up The Color Purple, an incredible work, of course, and you've been awarded for that.
Yeah.
Don't take this the wrong way, but it would not be the first thing that would come to people's mind.
That it's a white girl.
Well, not that it's a white girl, that it's just you, given the kind of music that you did and what your history looks like. And you end up working on this work that maybe some people would say, oh, this might be outside her wheelhouse, but then do some of your best work there.
Yeah. You know, I can always tell. Now, the version that is out now and will be out forever, which is the revival that came to Broadway in 2015, and we've got the Tony for that, we got the Grammy. That version is much, much closer to how we in our heads envisioned it, because we envisioned it always raw and stripped down as we were writing it. Whereas the first time it came to Broadway, which I was thrilled it was there, but was a traditional Broadway musical. Tons of sets, tons of costumes, you know, all the stuff. Whereas this version is, it's on a Starkwood stage. There are no costume changes, no makeup changes. It's in your face. This version has been praised to the hilt. The original version, I could always tell if we were going to get a good or bad review. If it listed my credits as the Friends theme song, I knew we were going to get clobbered. Mm-hmm. If it listed Earth, Wind, and Fire and that genre, I knew they were going to praise it. So my feeling always was, if you really look at my stuff, especially Earth, Wind, and Fire with African influences, and it made total sense that it was me. But if you're going to say the Friends theme and Pet Shop Boys, that could be a stretch. I was always very adaptable, but without question, soul, R&B, you know, being my absolute mm-hmm. favorite. And, you know, when I first started doing it, people would say, well, how are you going to write a musical about The Color Purple? It's such a depressing story. Well, it isn't a depressing story. It's about someone who goes from absolutely zero sense of themselves to such a command of themselves that they end up affecting the entire community around them. So I view it, very much as I viewed Detroit, as an incredibly positive story, that there is nowhere to go but up. And we also felt that to accept in the time span of 2 hours that someone is going to go from such a wounded state to fully realized, loving, successful person, that we had to show that she had a sense of humor, which comes across in the book, never came across in the movie, not really. The movie still told a very different story than the book told. We wanted to be more faithful to the book. But so musically, even though some of these songs, especially at the beginning, are about something very harsh, musically, you have to give it that kind of feel where you can understand how a character can change so much over the period of 2 hours. And I felt like I did that a lot in my songs anyway, where I would take very bouncy music, but a lot of times have very heavy lyric in there. And I always use Boogie Wonderland as an example of that. But the chorus is kind of like a bipolar mood swing from what this person's feeling like in the verse. So So I thought if, you know, if I could take that and put that into The Color Purple, that, you know, would work. So
how did that project come to you?
One of my very closest friends, Scott Sanders, bought the rights to do it as a musical. And he called me in 1998, said, I want to take you to dinner. I want to talk to you about this musical. So I figured, oh, my God, he's going to ask me to write The Color Purple. It's going to be great. But instead, he said to me, I've chosen two songwriters, and I want you to give me your opinion on which one's going to be the best. And one of them was very famous, and one of them was so unfamous, I didn't even know how he got his name. You know, it was someone who could, like, walk into a party and play, sit down and play anything from a polka to grunge. You know what I mean? They just knew styles of music, but they weren't, like, a great creator. Based on what he told me he wanted, I actually picked the unknown one because I thought the famous one, having worked with him a lot, would never give it the attention that something like The Color Purple was going to need. But I said to him, you're not going to be happy, but here's what it is. So anyway, that guy lasted a year, and then Scott Sanders called me up again, and I figure, okay, now he's going to ask me. And he said, this time I'm going to give you the name of 50 songwriters, and I want you to just say yay or nay, and I'm going to have them compete to write a spec song, like no more hiring anyone blind. So I listened to this whole list, and he finally gets to the name, you know, and I'm not on the list. And he gets to the name Brenda Russell. And Brenda and I have been friends since we were in our 20s. And she's a great songwriter. She wrote If Only for One Night for Luther Vandross and Get Here, Alita Adams, a lot of stuff. And she actually was on her way over to my house at that moment because I had co-created a series that ran on a little animated series that ran on the original first year that Oxygen was a network. And so we were scoring it. And we were also scoring it with a guy named Stephen Bray, who's a Detroiter. He was known more for Madonna stuff, like Get Into the Groove, Express Yourself. And I said, well, I don't think Brenda can write it alone, but what if me, Brenda, and Stephen compete against these other writers that I'm choosing that we're going to compete against? And so Scott said, you know, that's fine, but no special favors. And I'm like, you think I'm expecting a social, you know, a special favor, and you've given me 52 names of songwriters and I'm not even on it? So the only advantage we had was that I knew who we were up against and that we, between the three of us, we had worked with all of them and they were all really famous. And with only one exception, we felt they were all too rich and too famous to take any time at all with a spec song. And you were supposed to pick something either from the movie or from the book, write your own song to like what you think would go in that scene. And, you know, one of the lead characters in The Color Purple is Shug Avery, who's a, you know, a juke joint singer. So we figure they're all going to pick the song that she sings in the juke joint because it just needs to be sung by a loose woman. You don't have to really interpret a character. And with the one exception, that's what they all did. And they handed them, all those people handed their songs in within a couple days, and we took 2 months. And, you know, then we got the gig, and then it was 5 years of hell. But it was still, you know, one of my favorite things I've ever done.
Does the songwriting process get any easier?
The answer to that actually is yes. I would, first of all, I am not a theater person at all. The fact that I wrote a musical, I am the least likely person on the planet. I can't stand musicals. I don't know why people are breaking into song. It was The Color Purple, and I wasn't going to pass that up. But the rules are very different for writing for a musical than they are for just writing a, you know, regular song that you, you know, pop song, soul song, you know, any kind of song. Theater, very, very strict rules about must be a perfect rhyme. Can't, you know, pop music or any kind, pop music meaning popular music. So, not, you know, that can be punk, it can be anything. Rhyming isn't strict as long as the syllables are similar, same type of sound. but you will get a horrible review just for one rhyme not being perfect. Originally, I thought, oh my God, this is so stupid. This is like a rule that has to change. But everyone kept warning us, don't defy that, because you could have written a gorgeous musical. They'll kill you. The critics will kill you for that. So these songs were much, much, much harder lyrically to write. It is unbelievable how much better of a songwriter it made me. And learning to interpret for character that way, and that there are a whole lot of people that have opinions about this. First, you just have to please the director. But, you know, by the end of before you're ready to actually go on Broadway, the wig guy has as much say. You know, he needs 23 more seconds to change the wig. You got to, you know, change the song. So all this stuff that I thought was making it harder than necessary, the quality of my songwriting once I finished The Color Purple, to me, was 500 miles ahead of where it had been. And then I also think the older you get, if you have been blessed with some success, you get more confident about your stuff. And you also know what stuff you can let go of. Like, don't hang on to that anymore. It's not a big deal. So, and I'm actually doing more writing now than I have in years. I find that it is much easier. And I always was a speed freak when I wrote, but now I'm like a bullet train. It's like, boom, she's done, you know?
My thanks to Allie Willis for taking time to talk with me. The Essential Conversations series is a production of Detroit's public radio station, WDET. If you enjoyed it, I hope you'll listen to other episodes in this series. Production provided by Rowan Nemisto and original music by Brett Lucas. I'm Ann DeLisi. Thanks so much for listening.